It is little known in Canada that white supremacist South Africa and Israel had friendly relations. This was true even when popular movements worldwide were organizing boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns to help end South African apartheid. The South African apartheid regime was successfully dismantled, and the boycott campaign played its part. Now, there are growing numbers of people worldwide who consider the Israel an apartheid regime that similarly needs to be dismantled, and think a boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign again can contribute to achieving this objective. Ronnie Kesrils is one of these. He fought for decades against apartheid in his South African homeland, and with victory served in the South African governments of Nelson Mandela and later Thabo Mbeki. In March, he will be traveling across Canada to speak on the need for a boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign against Israel. We reached Ronnie Kesrils at his home in Cape Town, South Africa, before he leaves for Canada. Good evening, your time, Ronnie, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Thank you. Very, very good to speak to you.
Could you sketch for us the major features of South Africa's apartheid structures?
Well, I think in the first place, what one has to understand is it emanated from colonial conquest over several centuries, first by the Dutch and then by the British, and this gave way to outright apartheid on the basis of racist colonialism of several centuries. In 1948, incidentally the same year that the State of Israel was declared, by a rather similar, although perhaps the world wasn't that wise to it in 1948, but rather similar colonial settlement, dispossession of the indigenous people's land, expansion, occupation, use of brute force whenever there was any slight sign of resistance, and then of course the building up of a whole framework of laws which were based on inequality, injustice, privilege from the colonial settler group, the whites in other words, who were basically the citizens of the state, and the black people marginalized and excluded and discriminated against in terms of property rights, which became non-existent, voting rights, of course, separation of amenities, deprivation of taxes that were to go into their communities, deprived, and of course under apartheid, the creation of the Bantustan system, in which the wilderness areas of the country, destitute, barren, were said to be for the indigenous black people, who were stripped of all citizenship rights in white South Africa proper. So from that point of view, one has seen, although of course no two systems are exactly the same, but a remarkable degree of similarity with the tragedy that befell the indigenous people of Palestine and occupation of particular territories, as we well know. Virtual stripping of rights of those 1948 so-called Palestinians who remained within Israel proper and who have become, to all intents and purposes, second-class citizens. So the overriding similarity being that with Zionist Israel, it's a state in which rights and privileges and citizenship, as the world well knows, are preserved and provided if you are Jewish. And in the same way, this applied to white South Africans and everybody else in Israel itself and in apartheid South Africa were denied those rights.
There were
and ruthlessly oppressed and exploited.
There were several aspects to the different fronts, I guess we could say, in the struggle for liberation in South Africa. And sometimes I guess we tend to forget these, and or people through age, not being our age, much younger, are unfamiliar with them. Could you again tell us what were the main ways in which the struggle against the struggle for liberation in South Africa was conducted?
Well, it actually developed along two lines initially, and these lines followed the two basic divides or cleavages within South Africa from very early times, and that was a class divide and then the race divide. And we had, from early times, turn of the 20th century, late 19th century, in fact, given the wealth and resources of South Africa, alone amongst African countries south of the Sahara, had developed a industrialized economy at the end of the 19th century, which gave rise to proletarianization of indigenous black people who were driven off the land and forced to work in the mines and the plantations and the factories. At the same time, a developing national consciousness cutting across the so-called tribal lines, ethnic divisions within the indigenous black people, which gave rise to a national movement. So we had, on the one side, talking about the latter, the creation of the African National Congress as long ago as 1912, and there were predecessors to that for at least 20, 30 years prior to that, which was seeking, along national lines, to unite the black people of South Africa for rights. And in parallel to this, with the development of trade unions, labor, socialist, even communist organization in the early part of the 20th century, initially, and I'm sure people in Canada find this interesting, it was rather paralleled by developments in the whole of North America, and this was the infusion into the country of socialists, Marxists, trade unionists from Europe, who initially developed the labor movement. But these two divides in the country, under this tremendous racial, colonial, and class oppression, very quickly learnt that they had much in common in terms of a common struggle against a common enemy of a white racist state and the oppression of that state and the exploitation of labor by capitalist class. So the national stream and the labor socialist stream began over the last century to converge and to learn from each other. This was a tremendous experience, and it created a popular front, if we could call it that, of the African National Congress, of the trade union movement, of the Communist Party. And if one could just dwell a little bit on the racial divide in the country, under the leadership of the ANC and the left movement in the country, was the development of national movements amongst groups, amongst, with the indigenous black people, the development of this African National Congress, which initially focused on the unity of all the black people. And then we had development of an Indian Congress, because we had still have well over a million people from the Indian subcontinent who'd been here 200 years now. And the mixed race people, the so-called coloureds of South Africa, equivalent now to about just under 5 million, just over 5 million whites in the country. And of interest was the fact that around this Congress movement developed a small group of whites, a minority, who very early came to take up the common demands of all the people of South Africa for equality, for liberation, for common rights, etc. And that was called the Congress of Democrats. So all of these movements became really one very strong, unified, mighty force, which in the end, using various forms of struggle, various methods of struggle, came to actually in the end succeed with the assistance of international solidarity, succeed in bringing about the downfall of apartheid by 1994, when, as the world well knows, the first fully democratic election took place, and ANC under Nelson Mandela came to power.
You referred to the international dimension, and maybe we can turn to that now. The effort to organize a boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign took many, many years, and certainly was a difficult challenge to mobilize. How would you sort of chart that movement of constructing an international campaign for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against apartheid South Africa?
Sure, we can date it to actually from 1958 to be exact, and that's when what we call the liberation movement, led by the ANC, began to call on the international community to boycott the apartheid government and the apartheid state. And that appeal was transmitted firstly through London by leaders of the ANC and the liberation movement at a time when a boycott of certain products in South Africa was underway, an internal boycott resulting from very severe repression on the farms, and the boycott was called against certain agricultural products of agro industry, these farmers and their connections with agro business. It was very quickly realized, given South Africa's trade with, at that stage, predominantly in the first place Britain, the trade developed very swiftly from the late 50s, but Britain had always been the key trading partner, having been a former colonial power. And that's is why the appeal first went through to Britain through the labor movement, the trade union movement, and the left in Britain. So the appeal went out then, and it was responded to very favorably by labor leaders, by trade unionists, by the church in Britain, people like Canon Collins, Barbara Castle, and so on. And it met with some immediate success. Within 2 years, the world saw the Sharpeville massacre taking place, in which some 61 people, men, women, children, peacefully protesting, were mowed down by the police, and about 250 wounded. That gave a tremendous impetus to protests which spread throughout the world. Britain, throughout Britain, but very swiftly to many countries, from India and Asia and North America, Europe, and so on, and condemnation from other African states, states to be This developed very swiftly, and the liberation movement led by the ANC quickly saw the need to appeal to the international community, to civil society in all its forms, like trade unions, parties, the youth, universities, sporting people and so on, and governments, to protest in solidarity and provide a means of being able to put pressure on the apartheid government through boycott and through isolation. I think the rest's history in terms of how quickly that was ignited, galvanized masses of people throughout the world, and how over the next three decades or so developed into a mighty anti-apartheid movement embracing the entire international community. And it became so effective that in terms of our strategic approach to the struggle, we talked about four pillars of struggle which would bring down what many people thought was impossible, would bring down this might of the South African apartheid state, supported by numerous Western countries. Throughout that period, no matter that at times they would denounce the worst practices. And we talked about, in the first place, the struggle of, the popular struggle of the masses of South African people, united in action internally using a whole range of methods against the apartheid state. And the other pillars were an armed struggle, a just struggle, a just war. Although it was at quite a low level, it was never a fully fledged guerrilla struggle of Vietnam or Mozambique, Angola, Algeria, and so on. Given the nature of the terrain in South Africa and the urbanization and communication system and so on. But it was a very important element in terms of inspiring our people and psychological blows against the apartheid state. That was a second pillar. The third pillar we talked about was our clandestine struggle, the development of an underground network throughout the country and in neighboring states, in terms of being able to get across leaflets and radio and the messages of the underground, linking with the armed actions, linking with the popular mass struggle, and giving the necessary political leadership and voice, because all the organizations were banned, that I'd referred to previously, from the time of the Sharpeville massacre, and were basically situated either in exile or very deep underground within the country. But this fourth element, that's not the least, it's not the last as such, last but not least, was this very powerful, popular international solidarity campaign and movement that I've referred to. It was very powerful in giving inspiration and encouragement to our people in struggle, and in terms of the isolation of the apartheid regime, in also bringing pressure to bear in the various countries of the world, pressure against governments to make them stand up and be counted, to condemn quite rightly the inequity of apartheid. And it played a most incredible, incalculable role in bringing about the demise of the apartheid state.
You visited Israel recently. What struck you as a person who has lived through the battle against apartheid in South Africa and seen that through to a victory? What struck you as similar in Israeli organization of their society?
Yes. Okay. Just before I get to the meat of that, can I just say I've never visited Israel as such. I am of Jewish origin, but I very soon, through my political association in 1960, as a young student, came to understand the nature of what Zionist Israel was, and I felt that I could never really go there. I never claimed the right of return and so on. I just boycotted Israel in terms of conscience. What I have done, though, is I've been at the invitation of Palestinians to Palestine on two occasions in 2004, when I actually met the late Yasser Arafat, and then more recently in 2006, when I visited, apart from the West Bank, visited Gaza, and all I did really was, having landed at Tel Aviv Airport, picked up by my government's representative in Ramallah and driven through. On the last occasion, I did, with some persuasion, take a trip to Yaffa and meet some people there and spend a very nice lunch in one of the Arab restaurants. But sorry to waste a bit of time just in terms of the fact of what took me to Palestine, and I prefer calling the territory Palestine. There is an Israeli state, of course. But firstly, and along with many South African freedom fighters, one was struck by the incredible, cruel, military, oppressive apparatus that exists, like nothing we saw in South Africa, which is why no less a personage than Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and along with many other well-known South Africans, we go there, we experience what it's like to visit Gaza, this great ghetto, open-air prison with 1.5 million people locked in, the West Bank, when I visited on the two occasions, under this military rule and occupation, with the military and the officials breathing the very kind of supremacy that we saw in South Africa. I just felt that it was like a time warp and going back into apartheid South Africa that I'd grown up in, a place just bristling with the military, bristling with a repressive apparatus. More than that, more than what we had seen in South Africa, the threat from the military at any moment of being unleashed against a civilian population. So it was depressing and it was grim indeed. But of course, as with South Africa, one encountered a tremendous, wonderful spirit amongst the people, amongst the Palestinians, who, as was the case with black South Africans, would never say die. One felt that to a tremendous degree. I didn't see violence when I was there on these occasions. There were no attacks, which have been continuous since 1947, 1948, when Zionist might was unleashed on the indigenous people of Palestine, and the horrendous use of this violence, this brute force, right through the decades. And you know what we've seen on our TV screens so recently in terms of the butchery that took place against a civilian population in Gaza, and what had been happening in the West Bank, and of course Gaza and under siege, and with the roadblocks and the checkpoints and the curfew and the villages. Well, of course, I saw all that in the two occasions that I visited the Palestinian territories. So it's shocking. It's incredibly shocking indeed. And it just makes one more angry, more determined to join in a worldwide movement to redress these wrongs and to bring about an end to the occupation and to support the resolution of this dreadful situation by redressing the rights of the Palestinian people, which have been robbed from them. And I think we ought to say this, because this is a very close point in terms of the comparison with South Africa, apartheid South Africa and apartheid Israel. And that is the liberation of the people in both places, the black people and the Palestinian people, and creating a society of equals liberates the colonial settlers as well. In the case of South Africa, the whites who were here and who benefited from the system and had the privileges, but were also locked into an insecure situation. And the same applies to the Jewish people of Israel, who feel threatened all the time and support their government taking along this road more and more excessive actions against the Palestinians and any form of resistance. So one sees that the resolution of this problem there will be, and I believe this will be, as has happened in South Africa, where the white people now find themselves liberated. And in this sense, it's the resolution to the problem there, and the fear and the insecurity that everybody feels in terms of their existence and their right to exist, and that's to be liberated from this dreadful, obnoxious system, which is the root cause of the conflict and of the misery taking place in Palestine and the state of Israel.
One last question. You referred earlier to a Sharpeville massacre in 1960, which really catalyzed the international movement, in particular for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Do you see any parallel with the impact that Israel's recent massacres of Palestinians in Gaza in December and January of this year has had on the consciousness of people internationally?
One senses that the game is really up now for Israel and the Zionist lobby everywhere. That clearly, unfortunately, because of the legacy of the dreadful, monstrous Holocaust carried out by the Nazis, there was enormous sympathy for people who settled in Israel. They've had tremendous sympathy and support over the years, which acted as a buffer against people being able to correctly see that what was actually happening was something iniquitous, that the victims of the Nazi Holocaust were now making victims of a indigenous people in Palestine who had nothing to do with those atrocities. And with the brutality that has occurred, we've sensed this in South Africa, and we've sensed this internationally, that humanity now is really saying enough is enough, and that the balance is now swinging against Israel and its very powerful Zionist lobby and those who support it, Israel Uga Amos, actually. And one isn't just talking about Jewish communities as the Zionist lobby. It's not only amongst Zionist Jews who have been supporting Israel. Israel that they've managed to galvanize governments and business and big capital throughout the world, and of course the media, the mainstream media, to a very large extent. But this is being eroded by the conscience of workers, organized labor, students, universities, religious groups, the churches particularly, middle strata, academics, intellectuals, artists, this is where it's like the critical mass is building up, and it certainly begins to take on the levels of the anti-apartheid campaign. And this is why it's so important for everybody who really wants to stand up for justice and fair play and equality, and for everybody to have a right to life and decency throughout that benighted region on the basis of justice and equality for all, that right-thinking people, human beings in their humanity. It's a wonderful thing we see happening in a world which over the last decade or more perhaps had tended to be dominated by conservatism, neoconservatism, people apparently becoming too engrossed with their own particular self-interest, etc. We've seen a movement building up now in which people are again, as has been in the case in humanity time and again, coming to the fore is the voice of the common human being who begins to decry the pain and the suffering that is taking place elsewhere, even if it's very far. So one is greatly encouraged by this. And, you know, let me say this, I've used this in many a speech that I've been making around South Africa, why we think that the tipping point's been reached, that they've overreached themselves in the open butchery against Gaza. And we've seen 150,000 Palestinians born within Israel taking to the streets in the towns in the north, the so-called Triangle, the Galilee, and so on. 150,000 people who are born within Israel and have been fairly quiet and, you know, dominated for so long, holding aloft the Palestinian flag and protesting against the butchery. And I use a wonderful example out of Toronto. The fact that a group of Jewish women staged a sit-in in an Israeli consular mission, and people in South Africa, and we've got a large Muslim community, large, of course, number of people of all backgrounds and colors and persuasions who attend our protests and our meetings and our concerts, they give that a most particular cheer when one uses those two examples. We've seen dockers around the world and in South Africa just 2 weeks ago, dock workers of COSATU, organized labor movement, refusing to offload a ship docking in Durban with Israeli goods. They refused to touch those goods. SCAD labor had to be utilized. It was a great step forward in our country, and we see this happening throughout the world now. Australia, Canada, Sweden, Britain, you name it, and it's taking place.
Well, thank you very much, and we certainly wish you a good journey across the globe to our distant shores, and in particular, we look forward to your visit to Vancouver. Thank you again, Ronnie.
I'm greatly looking forward to arriving in Toronto and Ottawa and coming over to Vancouver. I'm just at the moment waiting for the Canadian High Commission to issue me with a visa. So I hope to see you in about a week or so.
I've been speaking with Ronnie Kisrils in South Africa. He fought for decades against apartheid in his homeland, and with Victory served in the South African government of Nelson Mandela and later Thabo Mbeki.